From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Wiring the Brain. Every year, neuroscientists find out a little more about how the brain works and push deeper into some of the biggest questions of our time about the nature of consciousness, the age-old mystery of free will, and the fine line between life and death.
On the morning of the stroke, I just really didn't have any energy left in my body, and I curled up into a little fetal ball, and I knew that I was no longer the one choreographing my life, and either the doctors rescue my body, or this was going to be the moment of my death.
Certainly, without consciousness, there would be no meaning. But it's more than that. Without consciousness, there really wouldn't be anything at all.
Brains are automatic, but people are free. People are to be held responsible for their actions.
Today, what the new science of the brain is telling us about how we think and feel, even what it means to be human. Also, the story of a man who talks in his sleep and says some very strange things.
Hear my cry, Dotsiki, and tremble with fear.
Remember the Human Genome Project? The landmark government project to map all the genes in the human body? Now consider a far bigger challenge, a map of the entire architecture of the human brain. Your brain has nearly 100 billion neurons and trillions of synaptic connections, so the complexity is staggering. But that hasn't stopped a few intrepid scientists from trying to map what they call the connectome, the wiring between the brain's neurons. One of these visionaries is MIT computational neuroscientist Sebastian Sung. He's now written a book called Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are.
You could imagine a connectome as a map of a network, and I'd like to have people think about the back pages of airline magazines. You know, those airline route maps? If you replace each city by a neuron and every flight between cities by a connection between neurons, then you would have something that looks like a connectome, although your connectome would be the equivalent of 100 billion cities and thousands of flights leaving every city. Right now, we're focused really on small chunks of brains. Those of human brains would be great, but we tend to do our work mostly on small chunks of animal brains.
Even when you talk about something as small as a mouse brain, you still can't look at it as a whole. You have to go smaller and smaller and smaller, even to find the beginnings of this map, I suspect.
Yes, so all those connections between neurons, how are they made? You've probably seen neurons, and they are these funny-looking cells because they look like trees. They have very long branches. And those branches are like the wires of the brain. You could compare a brain to an electronic device. And the amount of wiring in your brain is really staggering. So in 1 cubic millimeter, there might be several miles of those branches of neurons. And inside your entire brain, there are millions of miles of branches. So it's an incredible tangled up mess of wires in there. Think about the back of your stereo, but multiply that by a big number to get to millions of miles.
Is it disturbing to you to think about the back of your stereo? I know that when I've hooked up stereos, it is not all that hard to put one wire in the wrong place and come up with a disaster.
You bring up another issue, which is that of miswiring. So let's consider certain psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia or autism. People have tried very hard to find evidence of pathological neurons inside the brain. Could there be dying neurons the way there are in Alzheimer's disease? And that's not typically found. So the theory has emerged that perhaps the neurons are fine, they're just wired up in an abnormal way.
How difficult is it to begin this kind of wiring mapping?
Well, we have to have images of the brain that are extremely high resolution, and that's provided by a means known as electron microscopy. That's the keenest microscope that we have. We also have to slice brains. These are dead brains. We have to slice them into extremely thin slices, 1,000 times thinner than a hair. So if we image each of those slices and then stack them up together, we'll form a three-dimensional image, a kind of virtual brain in an image. Once we have those images, then we can trace the paths of the wires, And we can also identify the synapses. Those are the points at which neurons touch and also communicate with each other. If we can do both of those things, we could map connectomes.
Well, I guess that brings us to the real question of all this. Why are you doing this?
There are many approaches to studying the brain, and I would divide them really into three kinds of observations. Some neuroscientists study the activity of neurons, the signals that circulate between neurons as you think and you feel. Those are the signals that are most intimately related to consciousness. Then there are scientists like me who study the connections between neurons. And then finally, there are scientists who study the genes that control the processes inside neurons. We have to have all three of these to understand the brain. Now, why do I find connections so interesting? Well, experiences are able to change your connectome. They're not fixed in your adult life. So the metaphor of the wiring diagram is a little misleading because an electronic device is not subject to changes in its wiring typically. But your wiring, your connections can actually change.
The example would be, again, the stereo system. You're always going to connect left and right speakers to left and right outlets. The brain may say one day, I don't like that anymore. I want up and down. Or maybe it would sound interesting if both of them were on the same side. We're perfectly capable of changing things constantly.
That's a great metaphor. And indeed, it's believed that your memories are actually stored by changes in your connectome. Every time you have an experience, it leaves some trace of the past on your brain, possibly by modifying the pattern of connections in your head.
Well, let's take a look again at one of the little pieces that you're looking at. I've read that one of your goals is to actually see a memory. I think even saying that makes people think immediately of science fiction, but that's not fiction at all to you, is it? So what would a memory look like?
Well, a memory would look like some kind of pattern of connections between neurons. The example I give in the book would be the memory of your first kiss, let's say. And let's say that's an indelible memory. You never forgot it. Maybe the appearance of your fellow kisser. Maybe the particular room in which that happened, let's say. The music that was playing. Let's assume that all of those stimuli are represented in your brain by the activity of different sets of neurons. Now, one of the basic principles in neuroscience is that when neurons are activated together, the connections between them strengthen. So the neurons that are signaling the presence of your beloved, the neurons that are signaling the music that's playing, and so on, they become linked together by connections. There's empirical evidence for that. And even after the experience is over, those strong connections can remain inside your brain and store the trace of the memory. Now, how does it get recalled? Well, suppose you hear the music playing one day, the same music that happened during your first kiss. That activates a particular set of neurons, but those neurons are connected to all the other neurons that were involved in that experience, and they can awaken the other neurons to activity too. So that's the theory.
This all, as basic science, sounds extraordinarily exciting. You are looking long-term at more difficult and perhaps more practical applications. I know you have considered the effect that this may or may not have in helping us to understand what you've called miswiring, brain disorders. Is that an approachable goal?
I believe it is. It starts to strain your imagination a bit with psychiatric disorders. Can you really have a mouse model of schizophrenia? What's a psychotic mouse? Can you have a mouse model of autism? And yet, scientists are trying very hard. Some of my colleagues are trying very hard to create such mice. One of the ways they do this is through genetics. So it's known that there's certain genetic mutations that can lead to autism. And you can take those gene variants and put them in mice and see whether the mice display any symptoms reminiscent of autism. It's an amazing idea, right? And the question is, can we find something different about these genetically altered mice's brains?
Sebastian Sung is a professor of computational neuroscience and physics at MIT. His book is called Connectome: How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are. If your mind is nothing more than brain chemistry, do you have free will? Was your decision to buy that cup of coffee, or to pick out the book you're now reading, really your choice, or did your brain somehow program you to do it? That's the question Michael Gazzaniga has been pondering. One of the founders of cognitive neuroscience, he's recently taken a more philosophical turn. Steve Paulson caught up with Gazzaniga to talk about his book, Who's in Charge?
You've tackled the old question of free will, whether we actually have free will in what would seem to be, in many ways, a deterministic universe. So do we have free will?
I think it's an arcane concept that seems just out of place, given the modern knowledge of what we're discovering about how the brain works. It's not needed. It has no utility to our understanding of things. What the brain is a great big information processing device that creates the illusion that we're in charge and acting freely of our own choice, right? But if you actually begin to understand how the brain works, you find that that's just not what's at stake here, and we should move on to thinking about the question of personal responsibility. And what I'm arguing is that the place to look for the answer to what responsibility is not in the brain, but it's in the social group. If you're the only person in the world, the idea of personal responsibility doesn't mean much. And so when we move into the social group, we have rules and laws, and that's where we look for responsibility. We don't look for it in the brain.
But there are real questions about whether if someone has had a damaged brain in some way, there's some part of the brain that's become impaired and they seem to be naturally more aggressive, more violent, or if there is retardation, should we hold those people as morally responsible if they commit some crime?
I think we hold them responsible, and then I think we move on to the question about what do we want to do about it. And that is a huge social question that we need to talk about. For instance, we should have a category of legal judgment where we say the person is guilty, responsible, and insane. We shouldn't have not guilty by reasons of insanity. So I think that you're on the safer side by saying we're all responsible, we all can follow rules. And then once we decide, well, he is the agent of the crime, he is the person that did the antisocial act, then we decide what we can do, what we want to do about it. Do we want to treat? Do we want retribution of punishment of some kind? Do we want just social isolation? What do we want to do? That's a very intense and difficult but important debate to have.
But I want to come back to this paradox that you have raised. And the way you put it in your book, you say we are personally responsible agents and are to be held accountable for our actions even though we live in a determined universe. Because it would seem that if we live in a determined universe, then we are in some way, we are not responsible anymore.
Yeah, brains are automatic, but people are free. When brains start to interact, there's a level of relationships, there's a social ether that's created, and you can be held accountable to play by the rules of that new level of organization.
It sounds like you're saying that everything is not determined then. We don't live in a deterministic world.
Well, no, I don't see it that way. The brain is determined, but people are to be held responsible for their actions, and that is a prize outcome that we humans want to have.
Michael Gazzaniga directs the SAGE Center for the Study of the Mind at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he's the author of Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain. If you'd like to hear Gazzaniga's take on the nature of consciousness, you'll find Steve's entire uncut interview on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind.
You can choose from phantom fears and kindness that can kill. I will choose a path that's clear. I will choose free will.
Daniel Levitin has an unusual history for a neuroscientist. He used to be a well-known session musician, engineer, and record producer. Now, he runs the Laboratory for Music Perception and Expertise at McGill University. And by using advanced brain imaging technology, he's brought his two passions together, to study the way we listen to and make music. Levitin came to our studio to talk with N. Strange Champs.
One of the things that you've done that's so interesting is you've looked at how the brain hears and responds to music, and then you have looked at the ways in which composers and performers have played around with music as a result. And you brought a bunch of examples for us. I wondered if we could talk about some of those.
Sure. You know, one of the things that's so special about it is that almost all music has this sense of momentum. It's going somewhere, but it's going somewhere at a regular pace. Music has this beat. And in most music that we listen to, across genres, classical, hip-hop, rock, jazz, there's this very strong sense of when the next one's going to happen. Now, composers play around with that a bit. I brought an example of Stevie Wonder playing the drums. Many people don't know this, but he's a fantastic drummer. And he plays drums on most of his records.
Huh.
And in this little cut I brought from Superstition, any other drummer, I think, to set this up would basically go or maybe if they were more elaborate, they'd give you a kind of repetition of the hit, and you'd know exactly when something's going to happen, and you'd be able to predict both when and what. Stevie don't do that. He's playing around, and through the whole song, every time he goes through this pattern, he plays something slightly different. He hits the cymbals a little bit harder or a little bit softer. He adds extra beats. He takes a few beats away. It's sort of a game that he's playing with you, and you're both in on it. He's drawing you into this kind of musical game or puzzle of, what do you think I'm going to do next? Well, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't.
What is it that makes music pleasurable? This seems like an obvious question, I guess, because we all think music is pleasurable, but why? I mean, when Stevie Wonder plays the drums that way, why is it we like it?
We now know, and it's pretty exciting, that there are pleasure centers in the brain, that when you have any pleasurable activity, these things become involved, and the neurons start firing, and they choreograph a kind of neurochemical release and uptake that allows dopamine to be squirted out through the brain. Dopamine is the feel-good neurotransmitter. Other neurons start firing that kind of stimulate your motor cortex and get you that tingly feeling.
So you want to dance?
Yeah, maybe. And it turns out that if you eat chocolate or if you win a bunch of money or you have an orgasm, these neural circuits come online, these pleasure centers, and they're the same ones that come online when you listen to music you like.
Now, related to this, I wanted to ask you about groove, which you wouldn't think of as a technical scientific term, but you have a whole kind of chapter, a section of a chapter in there about what you call groove. What is it?
Really, I'm using it to say something that makes you want to get up and dance or tap your foot or tap the foot in your mind. What's going on in your brain is that your cerebellum is trying to track the regularity of events in the world all the time. It's synchronizing, and in part of the synchronization, it's trying to figure out what's going to happen next and when. And the cerebellum's also connected to your motor cortex, so it sort of induces you to want to tap your finger or snap your finger or clap or move your foot. And I brought another example. I think Superstition has this great quality, but also I think Tell Me Something Good by Rufus has it. One of the reasons it has it is because it's not exactly the same each time. So what that's doing is it's preventing your cerebellum and the rest of your brain from habituating to it. Because the music changes around, it's constantly keeping our brains involved. And what you're hearing on the backbeat is a wah-wah guitar. So you hear the bass go boom, and then you hear a whack, boom, whack, boom, whack, boom, whack. And the whack is this guitar, and it's a little bit different every time, partly because the guitarist is really skilled, but also you're dealing with a human being who's not able to behave or play like a machine.
Another way composers and performers play with expectations has to do with chords, which chords they use. And there's a story you tell about Joni Mitchell and some trouble she had with bass players. I wondered if you could tell that story.
Bass players typically in pop music are playing the root of the chord. The best way to describe it is it's sort of like the anchor point. It's the point that your ear is drawn to.
It's home.
Right. It's the harmonic home. And Joni writes her and invents her own chords and her own voicings. and she doesn't know any music theory. So bass players used to ask her, well, what's the root of that chord? Because they wanted to know what to play. But Joni felt that the music lost something as soon as they did play that note. And uniquely among popular songwriters, she writes ambiguous chords, chords that could be interpreted in two or more different ways. So when she finally met Jaco Pastorius, the late Jaco Pastorius, the bass player from Weather Report, she met a really kindred spirit because he didn't ask her what the root was and he didn't look for it. He danced around the ambiguity, which allowed her music to maintain a more ethereal and I think really a more open-ended quality.
Is that what makes her music? Gives it that kind of floating quality?
I think so. It lives in that world of ambiguity. In a sense, it's like a cubist painting where you might see a face from two different perspectives at once. What the cubists were trying to do there was mimic the brain. The idea that the brain can recognize your face dead on or in profile or from all different angles. But the brain is able to process all these different views sequentially, and the cubist wanted to collapse across the fourth dimension and present at one instant both views of a face. And I think what Joni was trying to do was the musical equivalent, present both views of a musical chord progression. And Jaco allowed her to do that.
I met a friend of spirit. He drank and womanized, and I sat before his sanity. I was holding back from crying.
Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist at McGill University. He talked with Anne Strangechamps about his book, This Is Your Brain on Music. Coming up, why the two halves of your brain are so different. For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Wiring the Brain, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness. Brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Every so often a book comes along that changes what we thought we knew. Ian McGilchrist's The Master and His Emissary is that kind of book. A heady mix of neuroscience and cultural history. It's a densely argued 500-page study of the left and right hemispheres of the brain and how this divided brain has shaped modern history. McGilchrist is a polymath, a former literary scholar at Oxford University who went on to study philosophy and then became a psychiatrist. He tells Steve Paulson that we need both sides of the brain. But he says the left hemisphere has become so dominant in Western culture that we're losing the sense of what makes us human.
Now, it strikes me that what you're doing is almost a taboo subject in neuroscience, the idea that the brain has these two fundamentally different hemispheres, because a lot of brain scientists remember all that talk, 30 or 40 years ago about people who were supposedly left-brained or right-brained. Left-brained people are logical and analytical. Right-brained people are creative and intuitive. And scientists basically said, that's nonsense. And here you are going back to talking about distinctive functions within the left hemisphere and right hemispheres of the brain.
That's right. And the first hurdle I have to get over is that most people think they know what all this is about, and they think that it's all so rubbish and it's all been exploded. But what happened was that science discovered that all the things that people used to say, like that the left hemisphere somehow did language and reason, and the right hemisphere was sort of, I don't know, pink and fluffy and creative in a sort of slightly vague way. I mean, over time, we've realized that actually both hemispheres contribute to everything, absolutely everything that we do. And that has led people to say there's nothing there. This is a kind of blindness, however, because the hemispheres are manifestly different. I mean, if one is approaching it in a scientific fashion, one has to deal with the fact that the two hemispheres are asymmetrical. They're of different weight sizes and shapes. They have different gray-to-white ratio. They respond differently to the neuroendocrine environment. They have different preponderances of neurotransmitters. And when people have strokes or tumours in one or other hemisphere, they affect people in completely different ways depending on which side of the brain you're looking at. So it would be ignorant and it would be simply an act of dogmatic faith to say, well, there's nothing there, because there obviously is.
So the fundamental question, of course, is why is the brain divided into these two very different hemispheres?
Well, this is such a whopping question that people don't seem to have seen it at all. My view is that there is an evolutionary imperative for all birds and animals to pay two kinds of quite different attention to the world. That means two kinds of consciousness, really, at once. And they're very difficult to combine. If you think of a bird trying to pick out a seed against a background of grit or gravel on which it might lie, it's got to have very narrowly focused attention to something it already knows it wants. But if it's only thinking about that, it'll end up being someone else's lunch while it's getting its own, because it's got to have a completely different kind of attention, the precise opposite, a kind of utterly uncommitted, open, very broad vigilance for everything else that's going on in the world around. So you have essentially two kinds of attention. One that narrows things down as much as possible to a certainty so that you can pick it up and get it and sort it out. And this is very useful for manipulating the world. But it's not much good for understanding the world. For understanding the world, you need what I would call a relational attention, in which you don't see yourself as somehow disconnected from everything around, but realize how interconnected you are with it and need to be aware of all of it.
And so you're saying this relational understanding comes from the right hemisphere of the brain, whereas the manipulative side, the ability to control and master details, that happens on the left side.
On the left side, yes, that's right.
And a healthy brain needs both of these functions and the ability to switch back and forth.
Precisely. We're using both, or should be using both, all the time. The problem here is that while we need both of these attentions, the left hemisphere is the one that does the speaking and the organizing of an argument, and the right hemisphere doesn't have access to these benefits. In the book, I call the left hemisphere the Berlusconi of the brain, because it's the kind of political heavyweight that controls the media, so it's much harder to construct in language the knowledge that the right hemisphere has, a lot of which is implicit.
Now, what's especially fascinating with your book is once you take some of these findings about brain science, about the division of the two halves of the brain, and apply them to larger cultural and historical questions. And, I mean, your basic argument is that we need both. And,
yes.
And societies as a whole need both ways of experiencing the world. But you are saying that Western culture in particular has swung very strongly in the last few centuries to overvaluing the left hemisphere of the brain. What's the argument here?
Well, I mean, the first thing I ought to say is that it might sound a bit odd to talk about a hemisphere difference in a culture. But if a culture is an aggregate of individuals, it can also have a tendency to view things according to one or other of these ways of looking at the world. And yet we need to bring them together all the time. To do that, you need to have some tolerance of ambiguity, which the right hemisphere is much better at, by the way. The left wants to close things down to a certainty. It wants to know, is it this or is it that? However, important times in culture, like the 6th century BC in Athens and the Augustan era in Rome and the Renaissance period, certainly the 15th, 16th and early part of the 17th century in Europe, were times when people understood these things. They understood the need to bring opposites together.
These were healthy cultures. They valued these different parts
cultures.
Of the brain.
They saw us as embodied beings. They didn't separate the mind and the body. There's a sense of things as not just pinned down by certain kinds of abstract thinking.
And then, and then you say that at a certain point in history, and I think you, you more or less date it with the Industrial Revolution, the left hemisphere functions started to dominate. So there was a more of an emphasis on rationality, logic, precision, linear thinking, and the sense of the larger whole of contextual thinking started to decline in importance.
Yes, and you know, it's very difficult to say these things and still make it clear that I am enormously myself reliant on both factual evidence, using argument, and all the rest of that. I have no argument with reason. I have an argument with a kind of blind rationalizing of the kind a computer would do, which is not always appropriate to the human condition.
Part of your argument, I mean, to put it bluntly, is you're saying that we've started to think of humans like machines, like computers.
We have.
And that's wrong.
Well, it's clearly wrong. It's mistaken. And I think we have gone into a world in which we overemphasize our ability to predict and understand and control things through this kind of rationalization. This was the great thing in the Renaissance, you see. Until then, people thought, well, to find out about the world, we go to books. You know, Aristotle had it and so on. Then in the Renaissance, people started to say, no, we're actually going to look out the window. But the trouble is, the left hemisphere thinks it knows everything within its own closed system. It doesn't need to look out of the window.
Ian McGilchrist is a psychiatrist in England and Scotland. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain, and the Making of the Western World. Harvard-trained brain scientist Jill Bolte Taylor found an unexpected shortcut to inner peace, a path most of us would prefer not to take. In her memoir, My Stroke of Insight, Taylor tells the story of the unexpected stroke that wiped out part of her brain's left hemisphere, the weird euphoria that resulted, and the long and arduous process of recovery. And Strange Champs asked Jill Bolte Taylor to describe what happened on December 10th, 1996.
On the morning of the stroke, I woke up, and the first thing I really realized was that I had this pulsing pain behind my left eye. I'd never had a stroke before, of course. I'd never had a hemorrhage, so I didn't automatically assume the worst. And I just got up and went into my exercise room, and I thought, you know, getting my body moving again, getting the blood dissipating through my brain would be a good thing. So I jumped onto my CardioGlider, and I was exercising on this thing, realizing that as I looked down at my hands, they looked like primitive claws grasping onto this bar.
How long did it take before you realized you were having a stroke?
It was probably 45 minutes to an hour, and it wasn't until my right arm went totally paralyzed. And that, to me, was the warning sign of stroke. Everything else was just peculiar, weird neurological stuff.
Did you ever begin to feel that you were dying?
I did. After my colleague came and gave me help and took me to the first hospital, and the first hospital ran a CAT scan on my brain, and it showed this major hemorrhage in the left hemisphere. And then they shipped me by ambulance across Boston to Mass General Hospital. And at that point, I just really didn't have any energy left in my body, and I curled up into a little fetal ball. And the best way for me to describe it is I felt my energy shift. I felt my whole body become lighter. I surrendered, if you will. And I knew that I was no longer the one choreographing my life, and either the doctors rescue my body or this was going to be the moment of my death. And I have to say that it was, you know, you hear about these stories about it's an extremely peaceful experience. Well, for me, it was a total experience of euphoria. Mm-hmm. So I essentially found a space of nirvana.
Was it a disappointment to begin to come back?
It wasn't a disappointment, but it was definitely a process. And for me, it was a decision because I did feel this incredible sense of euphoria. I lost the boundaries of my body, the cells in my brain that understood where I begin and where I end, which made that definition, were no longer functioning. So I felt that I was as big as the universe. at the same time, I was still alive. My body had been stabilized. I was given another opportunity to live life, and so it was a conscious choice for me. So I can't say that it was disappointing, but I can tell you that when my time comes again, there will be no fear, and there will be probably an elation and celebration. So, you know, I just feel totally grateful for the time that I have on this planet, and when it's done, you know, I had a wild ride. What a way to go.
You lost so much from the stroke. You gained a lot, too, though. When the left hemisphere shut down, you suddenly were able to access all of the ways of perceiving that belong to the right hemisphere. Can you describe some of what that was like?
Yeah, it was really wonderful. You know, we have these two very different hemispheres inside of our heads, and they process information in totally different ways. And the right hemisphere thinks in pictures, and it is all about the present moment. It is analyzing and perceiving all the information from our sensory systems and creating a big, enormous collage of this present moment. And the existence of the present moment is beautiful. There's no judgment there. It's just it is. And when I lost the judgment and the critical analysis ability of my left hemisphere in that language structure and the ability to think linearly and sequentially and methodically and to make sense of the past and to project ideas into the future, I lost the past. I lost the future. I was given the present moment. And for me, it was a total experience of peacefulness and euphoria. And for me, so much of my motivation to recover and to reconnect with the external world is to help people recognize that they have this experience of deep inner peace right there in the right hemisphere. It's always there. If you allow the left hemisphere verbiage system to shut down enough to allow you to come back to the present moment.
You know, the experience you describe, I think a great many of us would give a lot to experience it, but you know, it's kind of depressing to think that one of the few paths is through brain damage. So, and the other paths, you know, Buddhist meditation or yoga or some of the other more traditional paths, they are very time consuming. Have you figured out through your own experiences any faster ways to shut down the left hemisphere for a while?
Yeah, I think that it's very important that we recognize that both hemispheres are always functioning. And I kind of I don't know who it was, someone famous said that, you know, the blue sky is always there. And to me, the blue sky is the consciousness of the right hemisphere. And then the clouds come in, which is the consciousness of the left hemisphere and the verbiage, and it blocks our ability to see the blue sky. But the blue sky is still always there. So I encourage people to pay attention to the two very distinctively different characters inside of your body. You always have the option, moment by moment, of saying, in this moment, I'm going to sit back. I'm going to look at the world around me. I'm going to escape all the things that I'm thinking about. And I'm just going to pay attention to how the air feels, the temperature of the air, my breath. Pay attention to feeling it come in and go out. Look at the colors in the field around me. Stop thinking and analyzing everything that's going on inside of your left hemisphere, all the jargon, then you can consciously choose to have that experience at any moment.
You make it sound so easy, but I don't think it's that easy.
You have to be persistent, you know, and I think that what I bring to this this story that hasn't been brought before is through the eyes of a scientist who specializes in the brain, we do have two very separate hemispheres. And I think it's a matter of recognizing that we are biologically designed to have this experience of feeling at one with all that is. And to be able to say, oh, all I'm doing is quieting a certain group of cells inside of my brain, you know, judgment, that critical judgment, not just of, yeah, I'm wasting my time here. Why am I sitting here doing this? I'm just wasting my time. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. The point is to allow yourself to get out of the fact that you think that you're wasting your time.
Jill Bolte-Taylor talking with Anne Strainchamps. Taylor's memoir is called My Stroke of Insight. Want to know the greatest experiment in consciousness? It happens every night when you drift off to sleep. Coming up, what sleep tells us about the brain. for To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Wiring the Brain, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Suppose you found out your husband talks in his sleep and says the filthiest, most outrageous things you could imagine. Karen Slavik-Leonard's first impulse was to laugh, and then to start recording her husband's nighttime ramblings. Soon she started a blog, first for family and friends, and then for anyone else who might be interested. The blog went viral, and now she's come out with a book with the same title, Sleep Talkin' Man. So how did Karen first discover that her husband talks in his sleep?
I suffer from insomnia, so Adam had fallen asleep with no problem, and I was lying there with the computer doing things, and as suddenly he said, "Enough with the cheese! Enough!" And I thought that was, I was really, really amused, and I ended up laughing him awake. And he didn't believe me. And then a couple weeks passed, and I think he said, "Little people are funny. Yes, 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 yes." And it just snowballed from there. And they just got more and more bizarre, because Sleep Talking Man is so extraordinarily different from my husband.
Well, we have to talk about this a little bit, and we have to be careful, of course, because it turns out some of the things he says are really quite nasty. He has
They're horrible. He's a jerk.
Yeah. Well, and a foul-mouthed jerk.
Yes, Adam is lovely. He's humble. He's kind and respectful. And Sleep Talking Man is exactly the opposite of all of those things.
As a matter of fact, I think maybe this is a good time to hear some of what he says. Well, there's one when he talks about an army of runner ducks. Let's listen.
Oh, yeah. There's my army of runner ducks. And they'll take over the world. With a waddle and a quack. And a waddle and a quack. I'm gonna rule this world. Yeah.
I really love that. But for listeners who couldn't quite understand it, what he's saying is, with my army of runner ducks, I'm going to take over the world. With a waddle and a quack, and a waddle and a quack, I'm going to rule this world. Yeah.
So this is a kind of recurring theme. Animals, we hear lots about chickens and badgers and hippos and...
Oh, and there's a thing or two in the course of things about guinea pigs. They seem to pop up regularly, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Guinea pigs make terrific drinking buddies. Just don't eat them.
Where do you think all of this comes from?
Actually, animals are probably a bit more part of our lives than is necessarily typical. So I'm really animal crazy, and Adam is partially animal crazy. But also, maybe they're just a great source of wackiness.
But it's not just animals either, is it? There was, here's one about aliens in space.
Do they know it's Friday in space? Do aliens look forward to the weekend?
Is it Friday in space? Do they know? Do aliens look forward to the weekend? You talk about your blog, Sleep Talking Man. And in addition to everybody's enjoyment of it, there's been a fair amount of discussion of whether this is, well, frankly, whether it's a hoax. It often seems just too weird to believe. Is it real?
It is real. And when the blog went viral, which came as a real shock to us, that certainly came up. There were certainly some people out there who, you know, immediately doubted it and said things like, this must be a big marketing campaign that's building up to something. And Adam and I had to think pretty early on how we felt about that. And what we realized pretty quickly was that for people who were going to doubt the authenticity, there was probably nothing we were ever going to be able to do to prove anything to them. And we decided to just be okay with the fact that some people would doubt it. Actually, loads and loads of people talk in their sleep. Adam might be especially witty, but it's not at all uncommon.
Well, speaking of how witty your husband is, we have one more that I'd like to end with. It's Adam claiming to be Mediterranean man.
Mediterranean man. Hear my cry. Tzatziki! And tremble with fear. I will cut you with my throwing pita.
Adam Leonard, recorded by his wife, Karen Slavik Leonard. Her book, as well as her blog, is called Sleep Talkin' Man.
And away.
Sleep may be an utterly common activity, but it's also the greatest experiment in consciousness. At least that's the view of University of Wisconsin psychiatrist and neuroscientist Giulio Tononi. He's one of the world's leading theorists on the science of consciousness. Tononi recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson, who had a basic question. What exactly is consciousness?
It's what goes away when you fall into dreamless sleep, or, you know, when you become anesthetized, or when somebody hits you on the head. So we know what goes away then. The world goes away with all its shapes and colors and sounds and fury, if you wish. Ourselves go away. We are not there anymore. Our friends are not there anymore. Nothing is there anymore. And then it comes back, hopefully, when we wake up in the morning or even when we dream.
Are you saying that understanding the nature of sleep is fundamental to understanding what consciousness is all about?
I think it's the simplest experiment we all are familiar with, which tells us that consciousness can go away and come back. But it also tells us that when we dream, we can create a whole world of experience, which at times, as we all know, can be indistinguishable from the real world. We have a hard time telling it apart, without being actually connected with the world itself.
So it's almost as if every time we go to bed at night, every time we dream, this is one of the great experiments in consciousness.
To me, it's the greatest experiment you could ever do, and we all do it every night. And animals, by the way, do it too. It is way in with consciousness.
Why are you so interested in trying to understand the nature of consciousness?
Well, it started a long time ago, I would say, during the time in which all of us try to deal with big questions and then usually abandon them because they are too difficult. And the number one question at the time was, what should one do with one's life, which I'm sure every adolescent has asked himself or herself. And so did I. And it occurred to me in investigating what should one do with one's life, which of course has to do also with the overall meaning of life and what is around us, and the issues above all of value and ethics, that there was a conundrum, which is, what is the place of consciousness in the universe? And without a better understanding of that, even questions of value and ethics would be very difficult to tackle.
So did you actually think about these things when you were a teenager? I mean, sort of wondering what the nature of consciousness is?
Well, I did not wonder too much about what the nature of consciousness early on. I was wondering more about what one should do with one's life and what was our place in the universe. And around that time, yes, I came to the conclusion that consciousness was central in all of this. And I haven't changed my mind on that.
Is another way of saying this that without consciousness, there's no meaning? Once consciousness enters the picture, all the stuff that's in the universe has some meaning?
Certainly, without consciousness, there would be no meaning. But it's more than that. Without consciousness, there really wouldn't be anything at all. And one way to look into that is to contrast two big pieces of our brain, the cerebral cortex, let's call it the cerebrum, and the cerebellum. I think it's a very good way to look into the paradoxes that consciousness poses. So the cerebellum is, you know, in the back of your brain. It's a rather old structure. It's very beautiful. It's very complicated looking. And it has actually more nerve cells than the cortex does. It has, you know, probably around 50 billion nerve cells. It has probably as many connections. It has all kind of neurotransmitters. It has maps of the external world. And yet, this is a very well-established fact. If you take out the cerebellum, even all of it, what will happen is that your consciousness will remain essentially intact. Mm-hmm. You will be the same person, you will have the same thoughts, you will see the same things, you will hear the same things, have the same feeling, ambitions, desires, and so on and so forth.
We may not be able to walk across the room, but we can still think.
Yeah, no, you will be able to walk across the room, but not very well. You will be sort of like drunk. But you can not only think, you will have, you know, your experiences very much like now. And so there is, in a way, a big mystery and a big paradox. What is so special about the brain in the cortex, or at least some parts of it, that give rise to all you are and all there is for you? And the cerebellum is sort of lacking this, okay, while it is certainly a very, very sophisticated piece of neurobiology. Obviously, there are some other parts of the cortex. We still don't understand very well which ones that generate who you are and all you experience. So there is clearly a fundamental fact of science there that says of nerve cells that are very much like each other, that do complicated things and fire along, some are arranged in such a way that it can give rise to experience, to consciousness, and most are not.
So the question is why? Why are some nerve cells crucial to consciousness and others not?
Yes, and what are the principles of organization that in one case allow consciousness to emerge, and in the other case they don't? And in fact, it's important in my mind to begin from phenomenology, that is, what consciousness is like, and then go back to these facts about the brain to understand what is crucial for consciousness.
Because the mystery is that the brain, what you've just been talking about, what neuroscientists study, is made up of stuff, of matter, and the mind, this mental experience, consciousness, is immaterial, is not apparently made of anything.
Yeah, and, you know, more than that, I would say that if you take it from the outside, you know, you can describe circuits that are more or less complicated, arranged in this or that way, perform this and that function, but you have no indication, inkling of the notion that in some cases there is somebody there, in some cases there isn't. So you must start from consciousness itself. The only thing I'm really sure about is that I am conscious. So there is an experiencing being that is me. That is certainly really real. You cannot deny that. Consciousness is, I like to say, all we have and all we are. Without consciousness, as far as I'm concerned, there would be nothing at all.
Giulio Tononi is a neuroscientist at the University of Wisconsin and the author of Phi, A Voyage from the Brain to the Soul. If you'd like to hear more about Tononi's views on consciousness, what he calls the integrated information theory, you can listen to Steve's extended, uncut interview on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind, where you will also find transcripts, dozens of other interviews, and our comic book on the science of consciousness. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Wiring the Brain, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our series was produced by Steve Paulson, with the help of Anne Strainchamps, Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Naya Mukherjee. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions wrote the theme music. Special thanks to two of our sponsors for Meet Your Mind: Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
PRI, Public Radio International.